You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Comrades, this is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and I'm here today joined by Dr. Matt Johnson to discuss the goings-on around the world and to be able to bring that right to you with our daily commentary. So, Dr. Johnson, let's just start things off. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on yet again.
Of course. It is always a pleasure to be able to have you and to be able to really break things down. A lot of things going on. Of course, Your special focus is within Russia and things involving Russia, and of course the Syrian civil war that's been ongoing, of course, involves Russia. And we have some new developments. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about what has just happened in Syria?
Yeah, over the last few hours, the Syrian news agency has reported a missile attack, and Air Force attack in the center of Damascus. It seems that, and then Russian press, FT and RT and South Front have all confirmed this. They seem to be going for targets that could be both considered Syrian and from Hezbollah. So they have a certain plausible deniability. If the Syrians get upset, they can say, well, we're really targeting these other people, which actually is not such a great concept, since Syria and Hezbollah are allied. Makes a lot of sense from the Syrian point of view, but this is clearly an act of war. This is an act of aggression. Syria has won, as you guys have just pointed out in the last commentary. And I guess this is their response. This is how they're going to go about winning friends and influencing people, by making things worse and worse and worse in Syria.
Well, I mean, with this bombing, I see the stories going on right now that Syrian military forces have liberated several more neighborhoods in the old city within Aleppo. And now the conversation is not if Aleppo will be liberated by the forces of Syria, of Hezbollah, of Iran, and Russia, but when. The clock is running out on ISIS and their so-called moderate affiliates that love to behead people just the same. And this seems to me, kind of a last-ditch effort of Israel trying to get involved to justify, if they can provoke a response from the Syrian government, then they can go ahead and get the United States involved in a further conflict before Trump takes office. And then this will take what is going to be a crushing Syrian victory moving forward. It's just been success after success to try and bog things down again before President Trump gets involved. Is that how you're seeing this situation?
Yeah, it's very crude. It really is. You're absolutely right. There's no question that Syria is going to win this. The population of the country, especially the Christians, are behind him. Matt Parrott's commentary, I know I might be a little biased, but his latest commentary is excellent. You have people who can't accept the notion of defeat. The West has lost in Syria. Russia has won big in a way that no one else had ever predicted. That they would intervene just then and expose the U.S. Arming and creation of ISIS and these other, Washington-based groups. I see it as a way to hit Syria when they're at their weakest. The claim is Israel is going after Hezbollah's military infrastructure, which doesn't mean very much, because they are allied with Syria and, of course, very closely connected with Iran. So however you slice it, it's still an act of war, an act of aggression. I guess kind of like Turkey last year, they're trying to do something outrageous to get the U.S. Involved because of treaty obligations and things like that. But it is just a very crude, just a missile attack out of nowhere. But it is right in the city. So it's really stupid.
Well, I mean, this has been a long time thing. And of course, Pastor John Hagee, I say, Pastor Anna in Echoes, not in quotations, but in Echoes, for what he is talking about, that, you know, he said before, the United States has to triumphantly march into Lebanon and destroy Hezbollah, as he's got that very distinct way of saying it. I mean, is this just continued policy? What else can the West do to try and draw Syria into this mix? Because an attack on a Syrian city, I don't care who you are. I mean, we could have a military base. I mean, we've got soldiers in our borders. Or, I mean, for instance, in Germany, we have United States military bases. If someone was at war with the United States and bombed a German city where there was a military base in it, that would be considered by international law a declaration of war against Germany as well, because you're breaking their airspace, you're dropping bombs on their soil, you know, on infrastructure of another nation that has a base there. But that would still be considered an act of war. Where in international law would this not be considered an act of war by the Zionist state against Syria and all of her allies?
Well, to be honest, I don't take international law very seriously. That's what the oligarchs have created for their own benefit. But just common sense. I don't need law. Common sense says this is a clear act of war by this is official IDF marked planes and jets and missiles. So there's no question about it. That's exactly what it is.
Well, where do you see this going from here? Do you see Syria taking the bait? I mean, I really hate this idea because I'm a strong believer in self-defense. You know, I think every person, every family, and every nation has a right to defend itself. But it does seem to me they're trying to draw Syria into this war, which will then allow the U.S. to get more involved. And then we're going to be really back to this, I mean, possibly going, making this war go hot. I mean, that was the fear that we all had if Hillary Clinton was elected. And I'm reading an article right now, actually, from the Middle East Eye that says what will happen when Aleppo falls. And there's a discussion in it that says that the rebels, as they like to call them, were waiting for Hillary Clinton to be elected. They knew they just had to wait for Hillary Clinton to be elected before they would get more support. And they didn't have a contingency plan for a Donald Trump victory, because Donald Trump obviously wants to work with Russia, wants to wrap up these conflicts, defeat ISIS, and make a safer world for everybody. So they had no contingency plan. And we know for a fact that ISIS and their affiliates do not attack Saudi Arabia or Israel, that that Israel's actually been providing medical support for injured ISIS fighters. And as Bashar al-Assad said, this is the best example that ISIS has an air force. It's called the Israeli Air Force. And it's been this way, attacking Iranian troops, attacking Syrian troops, attacking Hezbollah troops. You know, for the past 2 years, this has happened on a regular basis. So this is not a new development, but it is shocking as the rebels are being defeated, that they would really pull a card like this. We shouldn't be surprised when the Jews Jew, but it is what it is. But this seems to me that they have no contingency plan for a Donald Trump presidency. And this, again, you know, people ask, you know, why have we been supportive of President-elect Trump? And again, he's not a white nationalist. He's not going to make America great again demographically. America's already going towards Balkanization. That is going to be our future. But on the same ticket, it seems like they want to get President-elect Trump, when he's elected, into this where American troops might be involved, where our commitment in Syria is increased, that he's not going to be able to have a way to untangle this mess. I mean, do you really see this as just kind of a Hail Mary play by the Jews, by their allies in the Middle East, of course, which these Syrian fighters are? Do you see this as just their Hail Mary play? And do you see this likely increasing before January? Because, of course, ISIS has declared that Inauguration Day is going to be a bloody day, that they're going to launch attacks all around the world and in the United States to try and punish us for electing Trump and punishing our allies, because they know what this is pushing towards. Is this just them redefining and trying to draw President-elect Trump into a quagmire he can't easily get out of?
Well, it has that as a side effect for them, just a bonus for them. What Israel and the U.S. are doing now is forcing Assad to make a choice. Either you risk war with the U.S. and Israel, or you dump Iran as your ally. And that's a very nasty choice, a bad place to put him in. Russia's going to be central in terms of making his decision. Assad is in no position to reject Iran. That alliance is extremely important. So he's going to, if he sides with Iran, then these attacks may continue. If he decides to kick Hezbollah out of the area, which will be very unpopular, I think, he loses a tremendous strategic advantage in the area. So from their point of view, it's a very diabolically brilliant thing. But, you know, I've said many times that this the regime, the New World Order, you know, they're not all powerful. They're weak in many areas. Their governments are broke. And it's not out of the question to say that this is just a lashing out. They're angry. They lost. And now this is Israel's really upping the ante here. And you're right. ISIS is an American proxy army.
I've been saying that from the first day I ever heard of them. The whole thing was so ridiculous. We can consider ISIS actions the actions of the U.S. I think there's no problem in saying that.
Now, there's a couple things. I want to be able to talk about Richard Spencer's event he had last night in Texas that went off amazing. But a couple things before that, speaking of Syria. Just yesterday, I mentioned on the show that we're doing a story with the New York Times that's talking about nationalism around the world and how nationalists are working together. And the photographer actually had some interesting questions. And when I mentioned that the Traditionalist Youth Network, we actually held, to my knowledge, the only pro-Assad event in America, and this was like 4 years ago. Right there, really at the beginning of the Civil War, we came out in support of Assad as a fellow nationalist, of course, supporting the Ba'athist movement in Syria and throughout the Middle East. And I mentioned Assad, and this is a guy that works in the media. And I really think there's this disconnect between the media and the people, and of course, the media and truth. I mean, we've been using the lying press moniker now, especially as it's become popular over the past few months. And it's so accurate because this photographer, a guy that works in the media and has traveled overseas, spent a lot of time overseas, said, Assad, you mean the guy who's committing genocide? Because apparently there was a discussion in there, he was working with a team that was talking about Assad genociding his own people. And the guy seemed, I'm not going to say that he was like the best. He definitely wasn't one of us, but he also didn't seem like a malicious leftist. We actually spent a lot of time having a dialogue and answering questions and asking questions back. And he didn't seem like a bad guy, all things considered. You know, he wasn't Jewish. He was a white guy who takes pictures, and that's what he's done. He's traveled the world and stuff. Not a dumb guy, but he really seemed to be really bizarrely confused that that we would support Assad, and he had heard nothing from the media elites other than Assad is some sort of genocidal dictator. That, of course, we know so many of the things from the Syrian civil war have been proven lies about like Assad gassing his own people, and then of course the Islamic State and their affiliates have used chemical weapons. That's been proven. But I want to talk about this disconnect that you see between the media, of where obviously the Jewish oligarchs are liars. The Jewish gatekeepers on stories, of course, have a dedicated narrative. But there's probably a lot of good people in the media that just live in this media bubble that don't know any better. And this is all the information they hear. So they parrot the lines without even thinking about it. Not because they're dumb, but that's because what they're surrounded by in this media culture. So I kind of wanted to ask your opinion on this idea of a media culture that is so insulated from normal people and so insulated from reality. That they even if you're good hearted looking for the truth, if you're looking in that well, you're going to get nothing but poison water.
This is extremely important to me, except I've been talking about academia for all these years, but it's the identical situation. These people have never heard our point of view stated competently before. That's one of the reasons that they're very impressed by you, because you're not, screaming with your fists in the air. When they hear us, they hear with my radio broadcast, this radio broadcast, they hear the stuff being put forward that way. They don't know what to do with themselves. Right now, I'm reading articles in Washington Post and Newsweek where they treat Assad's gassing of people in Damascus, his own capital city, as a matter of historical fact. They're saying it as if it's been settled. And you're right. They simply aren't aware of this. They don't understand. But the worst part is they seem to have no critical ability here. There's a short circuit, and that short circuit is really based on their careers. Why in heaven's name would he do that? Why would he do it in his own city using such a crude method, knowing full well that the West would blame him and turn this into a world war? It's absurd from so many different angles. But this is the isolated world that academics and journalists live in. And the only good thing from our point of view is that they're very soft. They come across one of us was talking like this, they don't last very long. We're not going to fall for the name calling or the loaded questions, and they're going to lose debates very quickly. And so they're trying to shut us down, like they tried to do with Richard Spencer. They've never heard us competently, heard our positions stated competently ever.
Well, and that's the biggest thing. That's why the left's position on no platform is so important, to use violent thuggery, to use threats of violence, threats of rape, threats of terrorism, and all these sorts of things, and then acting out on them in any cases, not only in Europe, but in the United States. They have to try and shut us down. Actually, I just had one of my videos yesterday YouTube notified me a legal complaint was filed in the European Union. And one of my videos where I talk about nationalist unity and nationalist victory was hereby banned from being seen by people in the European Union and in former European colonies, oddly enough. So I think it's a very interesting thing that their position of no platform is inherently correct insofar as our positions have the facts to back them up. Our positions are coherent. They're geopolitically wise. And when people actually get to hear what we say, then they realize that they've been lied to. They realize that we, you know, these are not just opinions. We're talking about actual verifiable facts in these cases. And the only way they can keep their lies going is by shutting things down. That's why things about World War II, you know, it's illegal to question the official narrative in many European countries. They actually throw you in prison. For if you're a historian, if you've got a PhD that's doing an investigation into these the things about World War II, they will throw you in jail for questioning it. They have to shut us down. They have to ban our Twitter accounts. They have to ban, you know, what Reddit's doing and shutting down all of the whether it was Pizzagate or other subreddits, shutting these things down. The only way they can maintain a hold on the really the mainstream population is by allowing their lies to be the only thing that people hear. This is honest to goodness as bad in my experience as you know, talking to my friends who lived in the former Soviet Union, where you had to only talk the party line, and anything that goes outside of the party line, you're going to face, just like in the Soviet Union, losing jobs. You're going to face persecution, even armed thuggery. I mean, what do you think in relation to that? This idea that we're really living in terms of the media and ideas, a very Soviet-style system.
Well, we absolutely are. But this is a concept that most people, even some of our people, can't comprehend. Institutions other than states and governments are just as capable of oppressing people as governments are. Because the U.S. is dominated by corporate capital at every level, it's corporate media, it's a private sector that's doing all of this. And people still have this superstition that only governments can oppress, only governments can commit genocide, can censor. In America, the private sector is doing it, and it's systematic. When capital gets as concentrated as it is in the West, and certainly in America, you have only a handful of people controlling these gatekeepers. When you deal with someone with a mental illness, especially if they have a delusion, and you confront them and you pop that bubble, you rationally and calmly explain to them why the silly crap they believe isn't true, you need to get out of the way real fast. They will react violently. They'll scream, they'll yell, they'll throw things, they'll do whatever. This is a very common concept with those with this problem. People with delusions behave this way. The left is behaving savagely. I wouldn't even have predicted this. Trying to secede from the country, different states, violence, threats of assassination. I can't imagine how the left, even amongst more civilized leftists, is gaining any sympathizers with this attitude.
Well, and that's what they have to do. I mean, they really, this is their only play, kind of like Israel, as you see. And to bring this into Richard Spencer, so we had an event in Texas just yesterday, and I think it went really well. I watched the live stream, and it was really exciting, and it was an amazing thing to see. There's a couple of polite, friendly, loving critiques. You know, when asked by a black questioner about, well, what are you going to do with us? I think the answer should be that Balkanization is the only path forward in the United States. The creation of independent ethno-states, new nations, where each people gets to live in accordance with their principles. If you're a progressive, if you're of another ethnic or religious community, you should be allowed to have your own state that you self-govern instead of trying to just have a European majority in America. Multiculturalism doesn't work. Multiracial empires don't work. I think that's what we need to be focused on, is creation of new nation-states. And Richard Spencer's talked about that before. So that I'll just lead off with my only critique. But I have to say, overwhelming, amazing event. He really shot down all the attacks by the left. It was absolutely great. Of course, riot police had to be brought out to be able to keep the peace. And you had all of these absolutely disgusting degenerates, whether they were attacking cops, talking about wanting to hurt Spencer. He actually had a great smackdown on this white cuck. This, you know, I know I need to lose a few pounds, but an absolutely morbidly obese guy that had a beat the hell out of hate t-shirt. And Spencer said, all right, if you want to beat the hell out of hate, like, back it up. I'm right here. Like, come and do something about it. If you feel so strongly, if you're going to wear a violent t-shirt, if you're going to say you're going to beat the hell out of me, then waddle yourself up here and do it. And of course, the guy didn't do that. They never do that. Leftists, you know, in many cases, when they are violent, it's only in massive mob attacks when they have superior numbers or they bring, you know, deadly weapons. They never want to fight fair. They never want to back up their rhetoric unless they've got a mob behind them. But I want to know your initial thoughts on speaking on college campuses, because this is a very rare thing. You know, even Commander George Lincoln Rockwell of the American Nazi Party got to speak at hundreds of universities, because in the 1960s, there was at least still an idea of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and then expressing and discussing these really you know, interesting ideas that, you know, the majority of the student body might disagree with, but at least inviting people to have these ideas exchanged. But, you know, I've never been invited to speak at a college campus. And, of course, Richard Spencer, he was brought in by an alumni, but not the college itself. That really, the college atmosphere has totally destroyed the ability to have really expressions on ideas and discuss ideas. And, you know, I think that's a really tragic thing. But I want to know, first of all, your thoughts about the campus culture and how things have changed in regards to having these sorts of discussions on college campuses, but also just in the event overall.
Well, I got my first death threat my sophomore year at the University of Hartford. And it struck me in a very weird way. I kept wondering, you know, I had this naive view that if you have facts and logic, and you can put it all together intelligently, that people will listen to you and they will have to eventually convert. But that assumes that people care about the truth. Universities are totalitarian governments. They control the internet of all students. They control the press on campus. It is a completely totalitarian state. It is what the left wants to do to the rest of society. It's extremely rare that when I'm engaging one of these people in a debate, 99% of the time, I'm explaining that their caricature of what we think has no basis in reality. That's almost 100% of what I'm doing. Everything they believe is a caricature that they learned from some pamphlet somewhere. It's a hothouse environment. I'll repeat myself. They've never heard our position stated at all. There's no major textbook with our things in it. Put in any way. The left has always been like this from the French Revolution on. They're an absolute cancer. But this is how, these are the Red Guards. Universities are organized this way. They're run this way. And I'll repeat again. When you try to dispel the illusions of people with mental illness, they will turn violent. And it shows, especially on college campuses, how privileged the black student body is. They have never heard anything but groveling from whites from morning till night, as long as they're on that campus. They can get anything. They can do anything without punishment. And having to hear an articulate guy like Spencer blow their mists out of the water very calmly and intelligently, it was really a psychological event more than a political one.
Well, I mean, and just thinking about, you know, talking about the Red Guards, you know, I was in Greece. I was amazed to find out that police are not allowed on Greek college campuses. Of course, after democracy was instilled and the military government left power, that the first thing the radical leftists did is ban police. And we're talking about, like, if there is a rape on a college campus, then there has to have a group of student leaders come together with the administration and the police to be able to decide and give special permission for the police to go on campus and catch a rape who is hiding in his dorm room or something like that. It's absolutely insane. So they have these bastions to organize terrorist attacks, like the murders of our Golden Dawn comrades, bombings of their offices, and these violent demonstrations in the street. They actually have specific nesting grounds where they're allowed to put out this poison and then organize without fear. I mean, they could honestly harbor terrorists, and they likely have over the past few years. And if they don't give permission, the state has no power over them. And that just goes to show that it's not that bad yet in America, but it very quickly could become that bad. I mean, this is the college campus. You're talking about safe spaces. They want safe spaces from consequences. They want safe spaces from other ideas. They want safe spaces to be able to plan violent attacks on people who disagree with them. And if it's already happened in colleges in Europe, it very easily could come and happen here.
South Korea is an even better example. You know, they have 180 leftist riots a year, an entire police force that does nothing but follow them around using riot control tactics. They're not allowed on college campuses. These are wealthy, upper-class students who want power, who want everything immediately, who want everything for free. They're used to hearing the word yes all the time. And sometimes they just can't deal with the word no. These are very privileged people. The people attacking Richard Spencer, a couple of professors, wanted to let everyone know that, you know, I'm on your side. Please don't hurt me. College professors live in fear of being called a racist or sexist, and they'll overcompensate. White ones will overcompensate and just be more militant than anybody else. But in South Korea, they have college financed activities for creating these riot, leftist and communist riot, groups. And so but a deal that they made is that we'll burn the place down unless you keep the riot control police off campus. So this is, having the totalitarian university, as a cell for their movement is extremely important to them. But that also means that these are rich, upper class, wealthy kids that are the mainstay of their movement.
Well, and these things never seem to change. Of course, the left is realizing increasingly that we have the ability as nationalists, that our position of economic social nationalism, our position of advocating for them, is the only one that can really mobilize and organize the especially the white working class, but the working class in any nation. We're the only ones who have ever made their lives better, and we're the only ones who have plans to make their lives better. It is always the defenders of the establishment that pretend to be radicals. They always do this in every single country. They are the establishment. They are, you know, German Antifa are promoting the policies of Angela Merkel. Our Antifa here in the United States are promoting the policies of Barack Obama and the mainstream conservative right and the liberal left, that they are the establishment. We are the true rebels against the system because we radically want to change the system and be able to actually speak for the average everyday working family. But I want to go ahead and close things out for today. And really, I just want to discuss with you just one final point and the idea of this, of rebels. We've talked about it before, but it's so important that, that do you think the left is scared? Because I really think they do. Their policies, they are, but as more violent and loud as they're becoming, they're really doubling down, trying to shut down even, you know, like I said, well-dressed, well-spoken guys like Richard Spencer, using violence to the point where riot cops with shields have to be brought out to stop them from violently storming the meeting. This seems to me an escalation, and it seems to come from a position of weakness. I just want to know your thoughts on that.
It is an exact parallel to Israel's attack on Damascus. It's a lashing out. They are losing. They don't have the facts behind them. They don't have right behind them. And violence is their answer. It's always been their answer. And the Israel's attack is the wounded animal lashing out. These people on campus, it's the wounded American left, privileged, lashing out. This is a class war. The working class are on our side. The upper class are those in the universities. Liberalism and leftism and Marxism has always been an upper class creation and an upper class tool.
Well, it's time to, if you really want to smash the establishment, time to be a nationalist. So, Dr. Johnson, thank you so much. What's going on in Syria, what's going on in our streets, everything is intricately linked together. This is the battle of nationalism versus globalism around the entire world. And it's so exciting to be able to get your opinions on this and be able to discuss this, because this is important. What happens around the world affects us, and all nationalists are in this fight together. So thank you so much for being here, Dr. Johnson. Thank you to my listeners. And I'm going to look forward to being back tomorrow with another edition of the Daily Traditionalists. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and hail victory.
You've been tuned into the Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.